The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Elisa Carcar, bringing you honest conversations to support and inspire you as we navigate this wild parenting journey together. Today, I'm joined by Grace, founder of Centered Mums Pilates. Grace is a specialist in pre- and postnatal Pilates, supporting mums to rebuild strength, confidence, and connection in their bodies after birth, with a particular focus on pelvic health and core recovery. Through her work, she helps women move away from pressure to bounce back and instead feel strong, supported, and truly centered in motherhood. Hi, Grace. Thank you so much for joining us on The Parent Show today.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So, Grace, can we start with you telling us a bit about your journey into pre- and postnatal Pilates and what inspired you to create Centered Mums?
So I trained in Pilates in 2010, and generally Pilates training is not very women-centered, which is quite interesting, really, considering, you know, a lot of women do Pilates. But when I started teaching, I hardly had any training in pregnancy and women's health and that kind of thing. And I worked in a lot of different studios across London, and I found that I would have a lot of women coming in who had these sort of needs that I didn't really feel like I could cater for, like whether they were pregnant, postnatal, or just a bit further along, but hadn't really done much exercise in those early postnatal days. So they were still sort of needing that more rehab approach. And I didn't feel very confident. So I went and did a pre and postnatal specialist course. And I don't really know why, because I was like 25 and I had no interest in kids. And I, you know, didn't really like babies particularly, but I just really fell in love with it. I just found it really interesting. And I think because the way that I teach, I really love like educating people. I don't want to go and just teach a class of loads of mindless exercises where everyone kind of feels a burn but doesn't really know what they were trying to do. And I think because I like teaching like that, I just found the like pre and postnatal women just really interesting to teach. They're really sort of receptive. They want to learn about their bodies. So I just kind of fell in love with it then. I then set up a postnatal class, and the babies in there made me think that having a baby was easier than it really is. And so then I had a baby. and what I realized is that mums who have babies like mine don't go to classes like that because the babies won't let them do the classes. So yeah, so I then got pregnant and moved out to St. Albans when my daughter was 6 months old, and spent the next few years working primarily with mums and babies and, you know, pregnancy. And then when I had my second baby, I just decided that it was just, I was doing like bits of other people, you know, teaching, like I had taught a few couples and things like that. And I just decided then to set up Centered Mums and really kind of hone in on what was already very much my speciality, but to really just kind of brand it that way, I guess, because that's what I'd been doing for a long time. But I think it was 2018 or 19 that I decided to make it Centered Mums. And now I actually, like, although I mean, pre and postnatal is really like such a deep love for me, because I just think it's so important. I really think that how you look after your body during those sort of really pivotal times in your life has an impact on the whole rest of your life. And but actually now most of my clients are people that I've worked with in their pre and postnatal period, but then wanted to keep coming to me. So I have my other classes are kind of quite pelvic floor and abdominal focused. And then I have a menopause class, and I'm just about to start some strength training classes as well. But yeah, I would always have a pregnancy class and a postnatal class alongside that, because I have so much knowledge about it, and I just think that it's such an important time for women to learn more about their bodies.
Yeah, absolutely. Postnatal recovery can feel quite overwhelming, really, especially with so much pressure to bounce back. I think social media doesn't help, just access to all these bodies to look at and compare yourself against. What do you wish more mums understood about their bodies after birth, and when and how should they gently begin moving in, particularly if they've had like difficult births, experienced tearing or C-section, or if they've had a, you know, very kind of straightforward natural birth? Like, what advice and what would you want them to know?
I think the most important thing is to know that there is no pressure, and that you can really, like, I rehab people 10 years postnatal and get amazing results from it. So not to feel like, oh my God, I have to get back into exercising as soon as I possibly can. But also to know that it's kind of better to do less than to do too much, particularly in that first year. So like, you know, it's one thing that's really common is for mums, especially if they were really active pre-pregnancy, to kind of feel like, oh, I really want to get back to what I was doing before pregnancy. And so, for example, maybe go for a run, which is a really, it's so annoying because it's such a great, easy way for mums to exercise, is just to, you know, get some clothes on and run outside rather than, you know, having to get somewhere or whatever. But something like that, it puts a lot of pressure on your body. And that, unless you've done kind of a rehab and strength building program to get you ready for that high intensity and that high level of pressure that it puts on your pelvic floor and your abdominal muscles, it's just not the best way to get back into exercise. So really what everyone wants to do in an ideal world is to do something, I mean, I would say Pilates. And I actually don't think, I know obviously I am biased, but I don't think I'm actually really being very biased in saying that. I think that any pre and postnatal PT, or, you know, someone who's getting, who knows anything about pre and postnatal, I think will pretty much always start with Pilates based exercises if they know what they're doing. So, and when I say Pilates based, I mean kind of on the floor. So lying down, doing things like bridges, doing things like leg slides, and really learning how to engage the abdominal muscles correctly. That's really the key thing, is once you've got the correct abdominal engagement, then you can start to load it and start to build on it. But it really is such a different pace for everyone as well. And I think that's what's really tricky, is that often people want like a hard and fast rule, like, okay, at 6 months postnatal, I should be doing this. But it's so different for everyone, you know, firstly, just based on your previous fitness levels for one thing, but also, you know, even if you were really fit before you had a baby, if you had a really difficult birth, if you don't have a lot of support in that postnatal time. So, you know, if you've got somebody for that first 3 months, for example, helping you with the baby, allowing you to get, you know, which, you know, who has that? It's, you know, yes, of course, wonderful if people do, but realistically, most people don't have as much support as would be ideal. And therefore their bodies are really dealing with a lot already. So you might feel like you're not exercising, but actually you are using your body, you know, looking after a baby is a really physical job. So one thing that I really encourage people to think about is not thinking, oh, I need to exercise, but thinking, how can I use my body well each day? So for example, instead of thinking, oh, I need to create half an hour to do loads of Pilates, which yes, if you can do that, amazing. But if you can't, which, you know, a lot of people can't manage to create that amount of time when they're looking after a young baby, to think that when you're moving, how can you support your body better? So when we breathe out, our abdominals draw inwards and our pelvic floor lifts up at the same time. So if every time you pick your baby up, you breathe out, you will really give your abdominals and your pelvic floor more support. So even something as simple as that, each time I pick my baby up, I do it on an out breath and try and pull the abdominals inwards. And that doesn't just mean like squeezing and gripping the abdominals. It means really trying to work to get a sense of it, the abdominals drawing in and flattening. Then just something as simple as that can make a really big difference. And then, and you know, something like just lifting, making sure that you lift your arms up over your head every day. It's really easy when you're looking after a baby to just get really stuck through the upper body. And if you get stuck in your shoulders and your neck, then it means that your breathing patterns are going to change, and you might end up that your ribs don't move as much when you breathe, which means that more pressure goes down into your abdominals and your pelvic floor. So even if all you did every day was lift your arms up over your head a few times and try and think of supporting your abdominals when you're lifting your baby up, those little things can make a really big difference. Because even if you're doing half an hour of exercise every day, if you think about how many more hours there are to look after, you know, to for your body to need to be doing things, half an hour actually is nothing compared to like using your body well the rest of the time. Another tip that I often give is to think about where your pelvis is. So often when a mum's holding a baby, she often will kind of throw her pelvis either off to one side to put the baby on the hip, or like throw the pelvis forward and kind of hold the baby into the chest and throw the hips forward. All of those things kind of skewiff everything through the body. So if you can try and think, whenever you think of it, where is my pelvis? Can I stack my pelvis over my ankles? Then that is, again, like your abdominals will just support you a little bit better if you kind of get your joints and your sort of all of the bony bits in the right places. So things like that can be really helpful. Like, of course, in an ideal world, everyone would do, I tend to say to people, if you can try and do 10 minutes a day, that will make a massive difference. Like, you don't need to think that you need to create an hour, half an hour, even 20 minutes. Like, if you did 5 minutes a day, you would notice a difference. And then, you know, any more you can do on top of that, great. But if you think about over a week, I have to do my five times tables now, but I think 5 7 is 35. So, you know, that's 35 minutes through the week of exercise. So if you do it 5 minutes a day, and then maybe once a week you can get to a class, or, you know, or not, then that's really going to add up and help you. But what I would also say is, like, I know, like, my older one especially really didn't sleep. And so it was so hard for me to get the energy to do very much for myself at all, because any chance I got, I just wanted to rest. And that is also okay. Like, I just really think it's so important for people to understand that, yes, like, there's all these kind of ideal things. And, you know, if you have a private chef and you have someone looking after your baby so you can exercise and all of those things that you might see on social media, amazing. You might, you know, your body might start to feel quite good by the time you're 3 to 6 months postnatal. But for people who are living in a more normal environment, it does take time. And even with loads of support, it takes time. But with the amount of support that most people have, it really does take time. And I tend to say that, you know, try and think for that first year that do as much as you can, but don't put loads of pressure on yourself. If you feel really overwhelmed, if you feel like it just, you know, it's a lot, then put it on the, you know that you can come back to it. But the biggest thing I would say is don't skip the stuff that I'm talking about and the abdominal connection and the deep strength work, and just think, oh, I've missed, you know, I'm a year postnatal now, so I don't need to do any of that stuff. I'm just going to start running. That stuff needs to come in first, whatever stage it is. And like I say, I do it with people at 10 years postnatal. And you know, in some ways, that's a great time to start, because you actually do have time by the time, or hopefully you have some time by the time your kids are kind of 10. And so, yeah, that was a long answer. But
yeah, no, it was a great answer. Loads of good tips. So breathe out when you pick up your baby, and that is going to be multiple times a day. Make sure you know where your pelvis is and keeping it centered. And then 5 minutes a day, that feels achievable. What about Kegels or Kegels? I never know how to pronounce
them. Yeah, so I say Kegels. I think that's right. So Kegels are the kind of lift and squeeze that the midwives tell you to do postnatally. And they have a really useful job, which is to kind of help you to know where your pelvic floor is, help you to feel your pelvic floor. They're really helpful for sort of medical professionals. Physios can go in and check your pelvic floor, and you can squeeze and they can see, oh, is the pelvic floor responding? And there's loads of evidence to show that Kegels, you know, if you do your sets of Kegels, they can be a really useful thing to do to get the pelvic floor stronger. But the way that I usually talk about it is that it's like the Kegel is like a piece of the puzzle when it comes to pelvic floor health. It's not, we're kind of given this narrative that Kegels are pelvic floor health. You know, like if you go to the doctor, they'll generally say, if you were leaking or had any pelvic floor problems, they'll generally say, do 10 lots of Kegels 3 times a day, and that should make a difference. That can make a difference. And I'm not saying that they are a complete waste of time, but if your pelvic floor, for example, is really tight, then actually squeezing it 10 to, doing your sets of Kegels 3 times a day is not actually going to help you, because all it's going to do is create tension in the pelvic floor. And that there's been studies that have shown that about half of women who are just given do Kegels as a cue to doing them don't do them right. So I'm always referring people to pelvic health physios. It's a really good idea if you've got any concerns about your pelvic floor. And actually, even if you haven't, if you've had a baby, the ideal is that you have your pelvic floor checked by a pelvic floor physio. And in other countries, they get that as part of, you know, being a mum. But sadly, we don't have that. But if you have any issues, you can go to your GP and ask for a pelvic health physio referral, and you should be able to get one. And they might, you know, sometimes they push back a bit and they kind of say, oh, you know, it's normal. It's not normal. If you're having any, if you're leaking, if you've got feelings of heaviness, if you've got any symptoms that just don't feel quite right down there, you really are completely entitled to go and get support for it. And sometimes, like, and I think the big thing, I think the stat is that women tend to wait an average of 6 years from experiencing symptoms to seeking help. And I can tell you from my experience of, or in my own body, but also in like thousands of clients that I've worked with, that the sooner you work on these issues, the more easily you can resolve them. So if you wait 6 years, the chances are that what could have been sorted out in a fairly straightforward way is just going to be that bit more complicated. So if you have any concerns, do reach out to somebody. Like, always feel free to contact me. I don't tend to, if someone's got issues, I tend to immediately just refer them to a physio, and then they can come back to me once they've got a bit more information and we know what's going on. And then the other thing with Kegels is, or sort of around pelvic floor health, and the big thing that I talk about when I sort of say that Kegels aren't the only thing to think about, is that just doing your Kegels is a bit like trying to strengthen your bicep, so, you know, your arm muscles, just by squeezing and releasing your arms. If you think about your biceps, I think most people know what a bicep curl is, like hold a weight and then bend your elbow and then stretch your arm again. We would always know that to build strength in our bicep, we need to add weight and movement. But for some reason, we've got into this narrative that the pelvic floor doesn't work like that, but it does. So your pelvic floor needs weight and movement. Your pelvic floor needs for you to move. And there was a study done in 2016 that showed that there's a list of exercises that give a stronger pelvic floor contraction than a Kegel on its own. And they included things like squats, like bridges, like lunges, and all kind of Pilates-based stuff, basically. And even a cat, so, you know, like the yoga pose on all fours, tuck your pelvis under and release, I think gave like something like a 30-something percent stronger contraction in the pelvic floor than a Kegel does. And the good thing about those kind of exercises is that it doesn't really... So, like, with a Kegel, you need to know if your pelvic floor is tight or not, and then, because then you kind of know where to focus. Whereas with something like a cat, you get the contraction of the pelvic floor as you round your spine, and then your pelvic floor will release as you come into a flat back again. So though, like, it just, it sort of takes out the, oh, I don't know if I'm doing it right. It is going to do it right if you're, because your body is just responding to the move.
Yeah, you're not having to do the thinking. I definitely remember that. I think the only advice I was given postnatally was these Kegels. And I didn't really know what I was doing. At first, I couldn't do anything. I was like, I'm trying, but nothing's happening. I think it was actually coming to your class when I first moved to St. Albans and realizing, oh, I think I've overstrengthened that. And I actually, it's more this functional movement, and it just happens naturally then. And then you kind of know that you're on the right path a little bit. And kind of, you mentioned a couple of signs there that are what should be addressed that are quite common but not necessarily normal. So what can you remind us what those key signs were?
Yeah, some of the key things that people experience that are signs that your pelvic floor isn't working as well as it could are leaking. So, you know, if, like, when you laugh or cough or jump or sneeze, if you get a little bit of urine coming out, that's a sign that there's some kind of dysfunction in your pelvic floor. And again, that can, it's just as common for that to be caused by tightness in the pelvic floor as it is by weakness. And you actually, it sounds a bit weird, but you can be weak and tight at the same time. So finding out what's going on in your pelvic floor can make a really big difference.
Yeah.
And also just awareness, like, when, you know, if you're doing a squat, for example, like, I've had clients who have done squats till the cows come home, but they've never kind of tuned in to what's happening in the pelvic floor when you do a squat. Mm-hmm. So if you're doing a really good squat, as you come down into the squat, your sit bones will get wider and your pelvic floor will lengthen. And then as you push back up again, your sit bones will come together a little bit and your pelvic floor will contract. When you then coordinate that with the breath, so I mentioned earlier how when you breathe in, your pelvic floor lengthens, and when you breathe out, your pelvic floor contracts. So if you inhale on the way down from your squat and then exhale as you lift back up again, that instantly means that your pelvic floor is getting a little workout. So that awareness can be really, really helpful.
Yeah. I think booking yourself in with a physio as well is a great tenet.
I'm sorry, I got sidetracked then. So the first thing is leaking, and then also like prolapse symptoms. So like a sense of heaviness. Back pain is also really tied in with pelvic floor. I can't remember the number now, but there's a really high percentage of people who have back pain that is also sort of related to pelvic floor dysfunction. So if you have lower back issues, it can be worth, again, getting your pelvic floor checked, making sure that that's not what's, you know, that that's not contributing. And, you know, like I had an issue a while ago in my sort of left bum cheek that was, it was all just feeling really tight, and I was massaging it and I just wasn't really getting rid of it. And then I went to see actually a pelvic floor osteopath. We have an amazing one in St. Albans called Joe Day at Hearts Osteopathy. And she released my pelvic floor on that side. And then that was what completely sorted it out. And I'd been like working on it for ages and trying loads of different things, and nothing was working. And then once I got my pelvic floor released, and again, that's where just going to see someone is just so useful, because you know, I can't release my pelvic floor myself.
Yeah, brilliant. So valuable. And there's been a bit of a rise in postnatal reformer Pilates classes, which are the kind of the Pilates classes on the beds. I've tried it once. I found it quite terrifying, actually, personally, but I know people absolutely love it. It's quite an intense exercise as well. And I wondered what your thoughts on that were.
I love reformers. I'm sat here with my reformer next to me in my studio. So it's not that I don't think that they're a good idea exactly, but I train Pilates teachers in pre and postnatal. And I had an email today from someone saying, I've got someone coming to do a reformer class who's 3 months post cesarean. What exercises can I do with her? And I was looking through my reformer manual and just thinking, there is so little within the reformer repertoire that's really great for postnatal bodies. Eventually, it is great. But if you're going back to your first class postnatally and you're going straight onto the reformer, it's just a lot to expect of your body to go from having a baby to being like lying on your back with two legs in the air. Just having two legs in the air creates quite a lot of pressure for your abdominals. So the chances of someone being able to have two legs in the air and then add the weight of using the reformer to it is like, not many people are going to be able to do that safely postnatally. So it's really hard to say. Like, I feel like I'm sure there are people teaching postnatal reformer classes that are really good, because there are things like, there's footwork that you can do on there. You're not going to hurt yourself doing that. However, I would still argue that the best place to start postnatally is on a mat, to get that really deep core connection, because it's that deep pelvic floor and abdominal work that everyone really needs. And then you can add to it. And once you've got that, great. And so, you know, like if the person who's teaching the reformer class is spending loads of time doing that and then just adding in a little bit of footwork at the end, then there's nothing wrong with that kind of class. But, you know, I personally wouldn't teach a postnatal reformer class, and I haven't been to one. So I don't know exactly what they're teaching there. But for me, it's not probably the best way to start. Mm.
Start gently, start on the mat, start with your kind of daily functional movements. Sounds very sensible. And finally, Rose, for a busy parent who's listening, who might be feeling a little bit disconnected from their body right now, what would be one small, simple thing they could start doing today?
I think I would, again, just bring it back to the breath. So it's quite hard to explain without showing at all. But basically, if you bring one hand to your abdominals, and then breathe out and imagine like you're blowing out a candle. And hopefully when you do that, your belly will draw inwards and you can feel under your hand that your tummy is flattening in. If you can try and do that 10 times a day, and then, like I said earlier, try and integrate that, like breathing out, picking your baby up, I think that's really the place that I would always want people to start.
Brilliant. Grace, thank you so much for joining us today. I think your approach feels so supportive and kind of just steeped in expertise and empowering for mums. And I think there's been loads and loads of great tips there. So thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
If you just joined us, that was Grace from Centered Mums Pilates sharing her expertise on postnatal recovery, pelvic health, and how we can begin to rebuild strength and confidence in our bodies after birth in a gentle and sustainable way. You've been listening to The Parent Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Elisa Carcar, and I'll be back next time with more honest conversations to support and inspire you on your parenting journey. Until then, take care.
The Parent Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Thanks for staying with us on The Parent Show on Mix 92.6.
I'm Lydia El-Khoury, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Catherine Loke, who is the Director of Business Services at HFL Education. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us on The Parent Show today.
No problem. I'm delighted to be here, Lydia.
So today we're going to talk to you about how to approach a problem with your child's school. So I think this is a great topic to cover because I'm not sure we actually have open, constructive conversations around these kind of issues. So really looking forward to talking to you about this because it is a bit of a tricky subject and we'd love your guidance. So just say one of our listeners has an issue with their school that they'd like resolved. Can you help us navigate that in the most effective and constructive way, please?
Yeah, I think it is tricky. I think schools are incredibly busy places these days. I think they've had to absorb a lot of pressures over the last 5 to 10 years. And I think it's hard. It's hard to know sometimes what to talk to them about and what not to talk to them about. There's 30 children in a class. You know, I think sometimes the issues can feel really little and other times, you know, they can feel overwhelming. So I think, first of all, trust your instincts as a parent. Parents know their children best. And if there is an issue that relates to your child's learning, to their well-being, to their safety, or to their access to wider opportunities, the school is going to want to know about it. You know, schools want to work constructively in partnership with parents. And the sooner they know about an issue, the sooner they can resolve it. I think we live in an increasingly combative world where, you know, we see each other as enemies to sort of to complain and point score against. I think it's really important to see your child's school as a partner. And actually, you both want the same thing. You're starting from the same place. You both want the best possible start in life and outcomes for your child. And I've never met a teacher in all my time at HFL that doesn't want to do the very best by children and young people. So I think you've got that common ground. So I think sort of start with that common ground. I think there's a difference in the school between an issue and a complaint. A complaint is something that's very formal and once in a kind of complaint system is constricted by timeframes and formal conversation, whereas an issue is something you can sit down with somebody and have a conversation with and unpack in a really human-to-human way. So I would always say, if there is an issue with your child's school, unless it is something, you know, significant like a safeguarding issue that absolutely it's appropriate to escalate, start off with a human conversation with the person closest to your child. So in a primary school, that's probably going to be their class teacher. In a secondary school, more likely to be their pastoral lead or, you know, the head of year. And sort of have, by saying, can I have 5 minutes of your time just to talk about something, and go in with kind of positive intent in a partnership way, you're far more likely to get a really positive sort of outcome and sort of nip the issue in the bud than if you go in all guns blazing with a formal AI-generated complaint.
That's really helpful. And it's great that you've reminded us that ultimately that relationship with your child's school is so important. And the more constructive and friendly and symbiotic it can be, the better. Like you say, the world is so polarized at the moment. It's so easy to jump into an adversarial role, but keeping the calm and just remembering that obviously the school has your child's best interests at heart is key. Now, Catherine, I forgot the first question, which is about you and your role. Can I jump back a step and just tell me a little bit about your role and your background?
Yes. So I am the Director of Business Services at HFL Education. So I look after all of our services we offer to schools that aren't sort of classroom facing services. So IT, finance, governance, HR. So everything that a school needs to sort of function, I guess, behind the scenes away from the classroom, I look after. And I guess my involvement with school-based complaints comes from the governance element of things, because ultimately if a parent complains in a school, there's normally sort of three stages of a complaint: the informal, the formal to the head teacher, and then if it's still it's not resolved, it will go to the governors. So we tend to see the trickiest complaints that kind of get dealt with by panels of governors that are, yeah, at that stage really, really difficult to resolve.
Brilliant. Ah, so you see this every day. So it's brilliant to get your take on it. Now, like, honestly, in my day-to-day life, from, you know, my children are now and heading out the other end of secondary school, but throughout nursery, primary, I can hear parents getting irate about issues, some really minor, and that you think, why are you going to school with something so, so small when they have so much to do already? They're stretched to the limit. And then some are not minor. How do you make the distinction between what's worth bothering school about and what really, really just is maybe a little niggle that you should kind of put in the background and forget about?
Yeah, again, I think that's a really tricky question, because I think sometimes the really little things can grow into being big things, can't they? So again, it comes down to communication and just making sure you're having that kind of regular check-in with, particularly when your kids are really young, with the person that is closest to your child. And I'd go back to sort of what I said in answer to the first question. There's sort of a test of four, really. If something's impacting your child's ability to learn, their safety, their well-being, or their access to wider opportunities, you should absolutely be raising it. But if it's, I don't know, a mix-up around which day PE is on or what kit is needed in school for something, you know, schools are busy, mistakes happen. These are humans we're talking about. And there are 30 children in a class. So I think you're right. Sometimes I think just sort of recognising, okay, I need to let this one go and not write a kind of three-page complaint about it is helpful. But equally, we don't want unhappy children and unhappy parents. So the school absolutely want to know if something is up and something is really bothering your child.
That's really helpful. Thanks so much for explaining that to us, because it is easy, I think, even as parents, to just get so bogged down. And I always find it almost, the kind of pressure almost escalates as the year goes, where something you might be relatively chilled about in September, by the time you get to June, July, everybody's frazzled. You know, there's too much going on and you might blow things out of proportion unnecessarily and inadvertently. Right. So if there is an issue at your child's school or with your child's education, what would you recommend parents do at the beginning? You mentioned the first port of call is to have a conversation with the teacher who knows your child best.
Yeah, absolutely. Always start there, because, you know, together you can sit down and you can unpack things. And actually sometimes what you're dealing with is a symptom and not a cause. And actually being able to sit down with the person that's seeing your child most in school and, I suppose, put both ends together, because sometimes what you see at home is very different to what you see in school. And I think being able to have that conversation as partners in your child, so invested in your child's sort of well-being is really important. And sometimes, you know, 9 times out of 10, we can resolve things that way. We can't always resolve things that way, in which case, by all means, it's appropriate to then kind of, you know, talk to the head teacher and put it in writing. But the minute you put a complaint in writing, the communication becomes very formal. And again, if you are adversarial or accusatory, or it becomes personal, you know, if when anyone criticises us, you know, we immediately go on the defensive, on the back foot. And that's much harder than to sort of to row back to common ground. So I think have that informal conversation with the person closest to your child first. Sometimes you just need to wait a couple of days before you have that conversation as well, because rightly so, as parents, we are so invested in our children, we get really, really emotional. And I think sometimes, you know, you sleep on something and it's not such a big issue the next day. So I think just making sure you're in the right frame of mind and you're sort of calm to have the conversation is helpful. And I think have that, you know, give that opportunity. I think put yourself in other people's shoes as well. If you were the class teacher, you'd want to know if there was an issue and you would want that opportunity to make it right. If it's still not right, then absolutely escalate it to the head teacher. And then your sort of next port of call, if you're still not happy with the outcome, is to go to the governors. But education is quite complicated, Lydia, in lots of different ways. And the governors have got a sort of strategic role in the school, so they can't get involved in the operational. So say, for example, you didn't like the class teacher. We get to June, July, I get we're all frazzled. And, you know, there's the class teacher your child's been allocated for next year you really don't like. That really isn't a cause for complaint, and the governors won't hear that complaint because that's operational. That is a decision of the head teacher. And there's nowhere really to go with that after the head. So it does depend on the issue as to where you can go and how sort of far you can go. But always, always start off with that, you know, informal conversation and see if you can really unpack the issue together. And that's the quickest way as well, because once you're into formal routes, there's time frames associated with things. And actually, you know, going back to what do we all want? We want the best for the child. You know, resolving it quickly is what we all want. So by having that conversation, investing that sort of 5 minutes early in a really positive way, that can get things sorted far faster than a kind of formal, you know, full-blown route.
Great. Thanks a million, Catherine. And what route? So the route available is like a formal complaint or an informal chat, constructive chat. Which route do you think has the most impact, has the most constructive impact?
So again, it depends on the issue. There are times where absolutely it needs to be the formal route. If there's a sort of serious safeguarding issue, for example, it wouldn't be right to go and have a chat if you were concerned, you know, about that person. But by and large, yes, the fastest, most effective route is to have that human to human conversation, because you can, you know, you can dig in further to issues. You can talk about sort of nuance. You can express, you know, emotion in a sort of safe way as well, and really help someone to understand how you feel. Or how your child is feeling. So, yeah, I would always say that that's the route. And I think I often see social media algorithms love me because I'm into this kind of thing. So I always end up seeing these sort of complaints. And you see other parents, you know, in comments, go to Ofsted, go to the DfE. And again, it's quite a complicated world out there in terms of these other routes. And I think keep it simple, keep it with the school, because, yeah, these other routes often... it's not as simple as taking it to Ofsted, because Ofsted will only look at certain things. And I think, you know, if you want this issue resolved for your child quickly and effectively, the best way is leaving it with the school. They are best placed to resolve your issue.
Brilliant. And so my next question, I think you've kind of answered already, but I'd love to get your take on it. So Ofsted or the Department of Education, not necessarily relevant and also very escalatory. What about local authorities? Do they have a say on what's happening? Because I think they're responsible for our local schools, but I'm not sure.
So this is where it does start to get complicated. So different routes for different issues. So we also have academies in the mix now as well. So if your child attends an academy, it's the academy trust you'd need to be complaining once you'd sort of exhausted the school route, and then academy trust report into the DfE. I mean, if the DfE looks at a complaint, they don't actually look at the substance of the complaint. They check to see that the process was followed. So that's not going to help you resolve the issue. If there was some kind of procedural impropriety, then absolutely they would help you. But that's a very different issue to kind of getting your issue resolved. Local authorities sometimes, depending on what the complaint is about. So if your complaint is about special educational needs and disabilities and a specific element of that, absolutely it sits with the local authority. Safeguarding sits with the local authority, some early years elements sit, but I mean, and I sort of live and breathe the school system, Lydia, and sometimes I get confused about whose responsibility things are and which route you're supposed to take. So how on earth parents are supposed to navigate the sort of fragmented world of education, I have no idea. So again, it's back to school. You know, school are your partners in your child's education. And I think rather than worrying about escalating it to other places, because all that happens when you do that is that agency contacts the school and is asking the school what's going on. So what you're actually doing is slowing down your complaint, because the time they would have spent investigating your complaint is now taken up by calls to the local authority, or, you know, calls to the DfE or calls to Ofsted. So there may be times where it is appropriate to go elsewhere, but again, the school can help direct that. And I've had calls to make complaints in the past around my child's special educational needs and disabilities, and I've always had a conversation with the school about where does this issue sit. And I've actually found them really helpful. Well, actually, it sits over here and we don't have direct control over that. But, you know, again, just working in partnership with them so you can go to the right place to get the issue resolved.
Brilliant. Thanks, Catherine. And my next question, we've all seen this happen where somebody takes to social media, a parent takes to social media to air their grievances about a school. And I think, you know, I feel very sorry for a parent who's resorting to that. But what would you advise a parent who's considering taking to social media to air a grievance?
So I understand it can be really hard. And I think, you know, emotions run really, really high when it comes to our children. But I would say don't do it for sort of three reasons, really. The first is that schools don't have a right of reply on social media. So the school policy will be they cannot respond. So actually, you can't solve it through social media because the school don't have that right reply. It needs to go through the school complaints process. So actually, all you're probably doing is creating more angst for yourself, because inevitably what happens is you post something on social media, parents pile in with their opinion, and that riles you up even more. And it kind of often can damage relationships because, you know, the school are not happy that, you know, you've put something over social media they don't have a right to reply of. The second thing is, I think, you know, you often see this, complaints are sometimes personal. They're about a teacher or a head teacher. And again, the minute you put that in the public domain on social media, the school have another responsibility now. So they have the responsibility to sort of investigate and solve your complaint. But they also have a duty of care to the person who's being complained about with no right of reply on social media. And again, you're kind of not really helping things. You're just creating a lot of noise and a lot of process, because the school will then need to kind of ensure that they are following due, you know, human resources legislation and policy and looking after that member of staff. And it can just make things very, very messy. And the third thing I would say is it really in the best interest of your child? So I picked one up on Saturday, which I just kind of thought, what are you doing to the parent? I did actually understand their beef a little bit. So they'd put a letter from their child's academy on Facebook showing the number of times their child had been to the toilet since September and the number of minutes they'd lost from teaching. And the parent was saying, this is a basic human right. My child has the right to go to the toilet. And when you read the letter that had the child's name in it, the school was saying, look, your child's losing valuable learning time. Can you please have a conversation with them and let them know this isn't okay? And I've got two teenage boys. They would be mortified if I'd put that letter on social media.
Absolutely.
Because everyone then knows how many times they've been to the toilet. And I do understand people's emotional reaction in the moment, but it's not going to help your child in the long run. And actually, that sort of, particularly if you've got an open social media account, you know, I didn't know this woman. I could read her business and her child's business. So, yeah, I would say don't do it. Think of the best interests of your child, which is going to be a kind of positive and constructive conversation with your school. And yeah, I think always it's the same with anything on social media, isn't it? Kind of take a deep breath, sleep on it. But it's so tempting at times, isn't it, when you've got it at your fingertips. But yeah, put the phone down, step away from it, get some fresh air and sort of deep breaths.
Yeah, sleep on it, maybe a couple of nights before you resort to doing it, because it is a bit of a knee jerk, and we're all guilty of it, of kind of lashing out. And yeah, it's just great to be reminded that ultimately it's in the best interest of you and your child to keep that conversation and that partnership as constructive as possible. Yeah. And I know, like, I don't know about you, Catherine, but I kind of got into the hang of using AI now, and it's helped me draft things that would have taken me hours much more quickly. And I'm sure this is being used by parents to generate letters to the school. Again, what would you say about doing that, about using some large language model to kind of generate a 5-page letter that blows off a lot of steam from your side, but does it help?
So I'm with you. I think that AI can be brilliant. In fact, I used it on over the weekend to sort of escalate an issue within my doctor's surgery. But for me, it was all in the prompt. So I didn't say, you know, Gemini, I write a 5-page legalese letter that's going to really rile up the doctor's surgery and, you know, cause a load of unnecessary process. But I did say, I want to work in partnership with my GP surgery. They've been great up until now, but I've got this issue with the wider NHS. It hasn't been resolved. Can you help me to kind of get them on board and working with me to escalate this issue positively? And it's the same with schools. So AI can be brilliant, particularly when you are emotional about something and you sort of want it to be rational. But writing a 5-page letter in legalese does one thing, which is to prompt a legal response, which is not helpful because you've kind of gone from 0 to 60 straight away and you've missed that opportunity to have that informal conversation where you're unpacking things on behalf of your child. So I would say absolutely not to do that. And artificial intelligence is artificial intelligence. It isn't human. And I think schools are in the business of educating children and young people. 95% of their budget goes on staff. They are the most human organisations you will ever meet. And I think having human conversations with, there's nothing more powerful, is there, than having a human conversation with another human being, sitting down and getting to the nub of an issue and working together to resolve it. And I think that's exactly where you should start. Yes, if you end up in the sort of formal realms of complaints, do use AI, but use it with positive intent. Don't ask it to write, you know, a five pager. Put yourself in the shoes of a head teacher who has already got a million and one jobs to do. And if they suddenly get this five page, you know, scathing letter quoting lots of legislation, and actually what I tend to see is the legislation that AI quotes is often wrong. So again, it just confuses things because you end up with this complaint you've got to unpack, and you have to go back to the parent and explain, I understand your concerns, but actually this piece of legislation isn't in this particular circumstance relevant. And a lot of this could all have been kind of nipped in the bud with an informal conversation at the very start. So yeah, by all means use AI, but don't overuse it and don't get it to take you from 0 to 60, because that's not a helpful sort of destination.
Yeah, so it's all in the prompt, which is a great
tip.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, great, thank you. So you're setting the scene really nicely and positively and constructively, and it's a great reminder to us as parents not to take the bait and to just keep calm. Before we let you go, any other thoughts about keeping that communication positive so that you get the best possible outcomes for your child?
So I think there's probably three C's. Clarity. So one of the things I often see is a parent will make a complaint and they'll use it as an opportunity to raise every issue that has ever happened while their child has been at the school that they didn't like. And it's and another thing, and another thing, and another thing. And sort of 6 pages later, you're like, what are you actually complaining about? So clarity. What is it that you want resolved and what outcome would you like? Calmness. So, you know, if you could be anything in the world, be kind. You know, put yourselves in the position of the teachers who are working, you know, night and day to make sure your child is getting a good education. So just try and remain calm. If you need to sleep on it, sleep on it. By all means, get emotional, because that's fine, because these are our children and sometimes it's important to show we care. But, you know, just make sure that things are kept calm. And finally, collaboration. I think really invest in your relationship with your child's school as a partnership, and that is going to stand you and your child in the best stead for kind of getting the best possible outcome from education. So yeah, three C's. Clarity, calmness, and collaboration.
That's fantastic, Catherine. So helpful. Thank you very much. And thanks for helping us kind of cut through the negative emotion and focus on the most important things. It's just brilliant. Really, really helpful. Thank you so much for joining us on The Parents Show today.
No problem. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. That was Catherine Loke, who is the Director of Business Services at HFL Education right here in Hertfordshire.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.